WBUR.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Nobody enters, nobody leaves. That's how Israeli Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer sums up the latest effort to crack down on Palestinian violence originating from the West Bank. And in addition to tighter travel bans, the Sharon government is reviving some controversial policies, deporting relatives of bombers and demolishing suspected militants' homes. But some Israelis are questioning whether military measures really increased security. Despite last month's reoccupation and a huge military presence, Palestinian gunmen and bombers last weekend evaded curfews and soldiers, launching a series of suicide attacks that claimed more than a dozen lives. Some hard-line Israelis are urging a Palestinian purge, a transfer of the entire population out of the occupied territories. Others want to revive the stalled effort to build a massive security wall. Meanwhile, some in the international community point to recent reports of malnutrition among Palestinian children, arguing that the government's already gone too far and needs to back off and ease the suffering of Palestinian civilians. Connection listeners, what should Israel's military strategy be in the face of continuing terrorist attacks? Is more military action called for? And will it, can it, bring security? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined on the line by James Bennett, Mideast correspondent for the New York Times. Hello, James.
Hi, Jackie.
Would you bring us up to date? Yesterday, this complete travel ban was enacted in the West Bank. The weekend was particularly bloody. Tell us what's going on now.
Well, there already was a nominal travel ban in the West Bank, but what the Israelis are saying now is essentially they're going to start enforcing it strictly, that when they impose a curfew on a city, they're going to maintain that curfew, ensure that everybody stays in their homes, and they're not going to allow Palestinians to move through at least the northern West Bank unless they have permits demonstrating that they've received permission from Israel to move about at least during daylight hours.
You know, I'm curious how this is being received by the Israeli public. There have been widely published reports that the World Bank and USAID is finding increased incidence of malnutrition amongst Palestinian children. And how are people responding to that?
I wouldn't say with indifference, but it hasn't caused the stir here that it seems to have caused abroad, partly because Israelis knew these studies were coming, and partly because many of them really do blame the Palestinians for the problem. They think that it's been mismanagement in the Palestinian territories, even before this conflict started, that caused the problem. And now a lot of Israelis do believe that the Palestinians have, in essence, brought this problem on themselves and forced Israel to take these military measures. At least that's what they tell themselves about what's happening.
What's the feeling in the streets and cities in the West Bank? Have you been there since this has happened?
It's a real mixture of despair, resignation, and tremendous anger and frustration. You know, before this conflict began, there was already a lot of frustration among Palestinians with Yasser Arafat, with the leadership the Palestinian Authority was providing. Nobody was more frustrated with mismanagement than the Palestinians themselves. The conflict, the enormous pressure that Israel has put on Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, his governing entity in the West Bank and Gaza, has to a degree increased sympathy for him and transferred that frustration, directed it more towards Israel. You know, there are two ways to go at the problem of terrorism, Israeli security officials will tell you. One is to attack the capacity to commit these acts, and the other is to go after the motivation. Mm-hmm. The Israelis are well aware that this current operation is doubtless restricting or attacking the capacity in the short term, but they're very worried that in the long term it's only going to increase motivation.
Well, in that sense, increasing motivation, talk to me about the controversial decision to resume the destruction of suspected bombers' homes, which has been going on and which the Supreme Court has apparently approved.
Well, that's right. That's directly aimed at this issue of motivation. There's a certain degree of purposeful flailing, I think, going on in the Israeli security establishment right now, because despite this pervasive military presence in the West Bank, I mean, they've seized control of seven of eight Palestinian cities in the last 6 weeks. Despite that presence, you're still seeing these attacks being conducted inside Israel. And there's a real search afoot right now to try to come up with some other way to restrict these acts. And so you're seeing Israel again beginning to demolish the homes of suspected terrorists or their families. They're also looking into banishing some of these people, the relatives, that is, to the Gaza Strip. And what's interesting is that although there's essentially a war underway here, it's a war that is subject, at least in some aspects, to various legal niceties. So you've had Palestinian families actually appeal to the Israeli Supreme Court, arguing that they should be given advance notice before their homes are destroyed.
Right, 2 days, I believe.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court today ruled that no, in fact, they don't have to receive such notice because it may endanger the soldiers who are carrying out the demolitions.
James, there's some feeling in some part of the Israeli public to transfer Palestinians to the Gaza Strip. We're going to go to the Gaza Strip. Stay with us, if you will. And we're going to speak to Lieutenant Colonel Yehuda Shaffer, who is currently on duty in the Gaza Strip. Colonel Shaffer, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good day.
Good day. You have been patrolling as a reservist. What have you seen since the weekend?
Well, we're confronting daily terrorist attempts by the Palestinians to infiltrate and hurt soldiers and civilians here in the Gaza Strip. And I lead a group of 500 men in a reserve unit who are all people, civilians, who have normal Israeli lives in Israel and who come to do military service this time for 5 weeks here in the Gaza Strip. The last time we were here was in December, and we've been called again because of the war of attrition that's been going on in the last few months here.
What was last night like? Take us out on patrol with you, even in the midst of this. It's a particularly tense time. Let's go out with you as you yourself are in the streets. What are you seeing, hearing, thinking about?
Well, we patrol the border along which defends the Israeli settlements here in the Gaza Strip and the military posts here, and try to do all kinds of military activities, patrolling and the other special activities inside the Palestinian territory to try and pick up terrorists and foil terrorist attacks, which, as I said, are daily, on a daily basis against us. What we see here in my unit is that although there is political disputes within the men, and many people have different ideas of what the political solution should be, if Israel should compromise or should not compromise, there is consensus that at this point we are in a war of attrition, and our goal is to ensure that Israel will have absolutely no, that the Palestinians will have absolutely no success with violence, that violence will not succeed, and that if we unilaterally leave Gaza because of terror, this violence will just follow us to Ashkelon and other cities in Israel. So it's a very unique. I've been a reserve soldier and commander for many, many years, and I was in the Lebanon War during other difficult times in Israel. But at this point, there's a feeling as if we're in part of our second war of independence.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the Camp David offer of Israel was rejected, and the Palestinians left the table, the negotiation table, there's a feeling that we must prove to them again that they can get nothing by violence. I'm sorry to say, but we feel that on the Palestinian side, there might be people who think that they can, by violence, just get Israel, destroy Israel, or have us thrown away like the Crusaders were thousands of years ago. I don't know what they are thinking, but we have to prove to them again, much to my regret, because we don't enjoy doing what we're doing, that nothing can be achieved by violence, and the only way is negotiating. The only way is to go back to the negotiation table and try to work out a fair deal between the two people.
James Bennett, Colonel Shaffer, Lieutenant Colonel Shaffer, referred to Lebanon. Certainly that was a slow bleed for many, many years. Do you see parallels between the Lebanon situation and the territories today?
In terms of the level of violence, the kind of violence we're seeing, or in terms of the effect that it's kind of had on Palestinians.
In terms of the number of Israeli citizens dead, the numbers called up to patrol the countryside, in terms of the political debate that gets engendered afterwards, the feeling that there's a limit to both military and political means, you know, just that it becomes an ever-present factor.
Well, there's a feeling in Israel and in the territories among Israelis and Palestinians that the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who was the defense minister, launched the Lebanon invasion 20 years ago, and Yasser Arafat have essentially transferred the struggle that they were having in Lebanon to Jerusalem's doorstep and are conducting a very similar kind of fight here now. And the debate within Israel is very much what you heard the colonel just now describing, also that the fear that if Israel makes concessions while the fighting is going on, they'll make the same mistake that many Israelis feel they made in Lebanon when they unilaterally withdrew. They've come to believe that by unilaterally withdrawing, while there was still some fighting going on, they essentially signaled that Israel would turn tail and run if you put enough pressure on them. And this is now a very, very big obstacle in Israeli public's mind to making any kind of political concessions or return to political negotiations.
All right, James, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Now we're joined by Gal Luft, former colonel of the Israeli Defense Forces, now a student at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Gal Luft.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me put that question to you, which compares the occupation of the territories with the occupation of Lebanon. Do you see military and political parallels here?
Not really. There are a few, but they are marginal. The difference is geographic. The difference is in the belief in the cause. Of course, one needs to remember why Israel entered Lebanon to begin with. It was because Lebanon turned into the country, the land of the Fatah, the land of PLO, which generated a lot of threats on Israel's north, and Israel had to move in and clean up that area. The similarity we see today is that what we call the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, have turned into a nest for a lot of terrorist groups that move in to and endanger Israeli civilians in Israel, and one could see a parallel there. But, of course, no one can compare the sentiment that Israelis have towards the West Bank and to that the one that they had towards Lebanon. Of course, there is no difference in the geographical barriers. Here in Lebanon, we had a border that defended the people, protected them, and in the West Bank, it's a very there's no border at all. It's completely porous, and there is hundreds of not hundreds, but at least 140 settlements with Jews living there. So we cannot detach ourselves from that territory altogether.
So you're talking about a much more emotional component. We'll come back to that question in the next segment here. Our guests this morning are Gal Luft, former lieutenant colonel with the Israeli Defense Forces, and on the line with us, Lieutenant Colonel Yehuda Shaffer, who's currently on duty in the Gaza Strip. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Boston.
I'm Jackie Leiden, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about the internal debate within Israel about how far a military strategy can go in the conflict with Palestinians. The number to call to get in on the debate is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests right now are Gal Luft, former Lieutenant Colonel with the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, and Lieutenant Colonel Yehuda Shaffer, who's currently patrolling in the Gaza Strip. Lieutenant Shaffer, you are not a spokesman, and I'm not asking you to be one, but we are talking about internal debate here. And one of the more extreme opinions that that's come out in Israel is the notion of some sort of transfer of all Palestinians to Gaza. I'd just like you to respond to what that would mean for people like yourself on patrol if such a thing were ever to be enacted.
I am no spokesman, but if I can speak for the men that I serve with and for public opinion, which I know in Israel, I think that such a solution will probably never be. Israel has always believed that being the just and moral side is the only way of being on the upper side of this conflict. And if we lower our moral standards to that, perhaps we will lose legitimacy and we'll lose our power and moral strength.
Mm-hmm. Let me correct myself. So, I think I said into Gaza when I think that the notion is to somehow transfer them out of both sides of Israel's neighbors altogether, both the West Bank and Gaza.
What I spoke about was regarding the notion of transferring whole population. Mm-hmm. If we are talking about measures taken against family members or individuals in an attempt to deter the suicide bombers, there I think there is a serious moral dilemma, because Israel has tried everything possible to deter these bombers, and so far nothing has succeeded. So perhaps in very extreme conditions, public opinion in Israel may agree, if I may speak on behalf of several people in Israel, it may agree to certain measures that are aimed at deterring these ticking bombs, deterring these suicide bombers from acting, knowing that their families might be hurt economically or may be displaced. But again, this can only be done if the connection can be proven and it can be shown that this will deter. I personally believe that perhaps this is the way to deter certain individuals from becoming human ticking bombs, because obviously not much is going to deter suicide bombers. I think American civilians, American public can relate to this fear of what suicide bombers can do after September 11th. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of fear we feel daily, and not with airplanes, but with buses and with the university cafeterias and other places exploding by these human bombs, ticking bombs. And so there is a debate going on how to deter these people by perhaps having sanctions against individuals. But as far as transfer of whole populations, I don't think this is on the table at the moment. I think Israel has always been on the upper side morally, and will always try to remain humane and as moral as possible in this conflict as part of its strength. Can I make a comment though on the connection between Lebanon and the Gaza and West Bank?
Yes.
I think there's a feeling here that Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon to the United Nations recognized borders 2 years ago was perhaps misinterpreted by many Palestinians as weakness, which led to this current violence. And we feel here in the IDF, and I'm speaking as a reserve soldier, I'm not a professional soldier, and I speak to my other soldiers who are also reserve civilians like as myself, there is a feeling that Israel's deterrence has to be restored. There was a feeling about 2 years ago that Nasrallah, the head of the Hezbollah, was leading the Arab world to believe that if only a little more will be done, the Jews can be kicked out of the Middle East and go back to Europe, go back to the United States, as the Crusaders did, and as if we are some kind of temporary state. I think restoring Israel's deterrence is a key factor in any peace process, any peace plan, because a peace plan means that both sides are willing to live together, compromise, live together aside, and I think this is what we are doing now in this war of attrition here in Gaza.
Galuf,
restoring Israel's deterrence.
Okay, thank you very much. Galuf, if withdrawing was perceived as weakness, what's perceived as strength doesn't seem to be working either. The attacks keep coming. You yourself have written an article in the July issue of Foreign Affairs called The Palestinian H-Bomb, Terror's Winning Strategy. Is it?
Yes, I did. Well, let's look at the whole picture. I don't think that anybody with minimal understanding of the situation can hope to achieve 100% security, total cessation of suicide bombing and terrorism. But I think that we also have to acknowledge that Israel has been very, very successful in preventing a great deal, up to 80% of the planned attacks. And I think that definitely that has to be credited to the Israeli security forces that such a high level of prevention and ability to reduce the level of violence that the Palestinians had in mind contributed to a situation that we still have the conflict under control after 2 years. That should not be taken lightly, because had the Palestinians have a higher rate of success, we could have had a different Middle East today. I'm saying it in light of the fact, and that goes back to the issue of transfer. And this is something that I think my colleague missed out. Even though today the mindset of Israelis is this is definitely not on the table, we should not be treat lightly the possibility of what we call a mega-terror, spectacular terror attack by means of weapons of mass destruction or something in the level of September 11th happening there. And I think that if something like this involves thousands of casualties in a small country like Israel, that could really, really be a huge change, and it could change the mindset of many, many people.
But can there really be a military strategy without a political strategy?
I doubt it very much. I think that there should be a political strategy. I think that there isn't a clear political agenda today of the Israeli government. And that is not helpful. I think that the Israeli government should indicate where it's leading, what is it, the end game that it foresees. How can it tell the mainstream of the Palestinian people that they have some reason to consider a different path than the path of violence? And if this vision will be registered and maybe accepted by not everybody, but at least the mainstream of the Palestinians, those that during the Oslo period were supported a political resolution, and what I see in the poll that there are still a great number of Palestinians that are in favor of a political resolution, then I think that we have a chance of getting the two sides to climb down from the trees that they have climbed on.
Okay. Let's get some of our listeners in. The number to call to get in on the connection this morning is 1-800-423-8255. Norman is calling from New Auburn, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hello, Norman.
Yes. I think that probably the solution to this is to get a United Nations force in there to observe both sides. And the Palestinians have agreed to this. The Israelites have not. I think the Bush administration should tell the Israelites that they either accept this United Nations force or all aid from the United States will cease. I think that this is the only way, because there doesn't seem to be any other way that these two entities can get together.
Galuf?
Well, we already have a United Nations force in a different place called Lebanon. They're called UNIFIL. About 4,000 or 5,000 of them have been there for many years already, since actually 1978. I don't recall that there have been a great success there. In fact, the mandate of the United Nations has been a complete failure. They haven't been able to prevent one Hezbollah attempt to terrorize and to attack Israel almost on a daily basis, even after Israel withdrew from Lebanon. I think that this is a solution that is very, very partial. We should be able to tell these United Nations troops what is their mission, what is their role, where will they be deployed. Israel, with all its might, is not succeeding in preventing terrorism, and I doubt it if the United Nations can do something that the Israeli military is really struggling to do.
It is one thing that has not been tried. It is something that the Palestinians have been calling for. Do you think that it? How much support do you think the notion for having the United Nations in has amongst the Israeli public?
Very, very little support. I think that the Israeli public is extremely skeptical about the role that the United Nations is playing in general. We have a very bad experience with the United Nations. The United Nations has been an organization that continuously passed anti-Israeli resolutions one after the other, showed a very, very unbalanced approach towards Israel, and it's very hard to change this image now, and especially in light of what we've seen in Lebanon.
Okay, thanks, Norman, for calling. What about the growing desire to see a wall built between Israel and its neighbors? This 225-mile wall, only 120 feet have been completed so far in 3 months' time. Lots of criticism against the government for not doing more. What's your position?
The wall is an important element in the defense of Israel. Let's remember that out of the 161 suicide bombers that came to explode themselves in Israel, only one came from the Gaza Strip. And the reason is that the Gaza Strip is surrounded by this fence. There are a lot of people in Israel, including myself, who believe that a certain wall or a certain fence that that separates the Arab population from Israel will make it much harder for the Palestinian suicide bombers to move into Israel and to carry out terror attacks. And this has to be completed at a faster pace. I think that the government has made a good decision by starting this wall, but I would expect this wall to be finished much faster than it is now.
We're talking on The Connection in this hour about the limits of the military option in Israel and its conflict with the Palestinians and the internal debate that that's fostering. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255 to get in on The Connection. Martin is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hello, Martin.
Hi. I think many people, including on this program, are quite frankly not seeing the forest because there are so many trees standing around. And that is, there is no military solution to this. I mean, as the experts have already been explaining, the level of violence or struggle for liberation, however you want to call it, from the Palestinian side, is never going to go down as long as the root causes are not addressed. And there's a very simple thing about the root causes of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that is that Israel is, however you want to call it over here, but it is a state that is an apartheid state, that is racist, and that is built on ethnic cleansing. Zionism has never paid the price to the Palestinians to acquire the right to build a state in Palestine. And as long as this is not going to be corrected, there will forever be war, there will forever be hatred for Israel, and there will forever be violence. And you can choose whatever combinations of military pressure, economic pressure, destroying people's homes, kicking them out, provoking a third wave of ethnic cleansing after the ones that we saw after 1948 and 1967. It is forever going to go on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
and
Martin.
And if anybody really wants to have this rate, then explain them that all the resources they are expending on the military, all the resources that they are expending on this war of attrition, are much better spent on actually offering the Palestinians a good deal which would convince them to give up the rights to the state that they and only they are holding, and tell them, okay, we are going to have a very, very good life. Yeah, we are going to build you good universities, we are going to build you good roads, we are going to build you good settlements for Palestinians, and then we are going to live in good neighborhoods. But as long as Israelis insist on saying, okay, everything is right that we do because we are Jews, and we have a right to be here, and you guys that don't have a right to be here, forget it. There will never be an end to this conflict.
Yehuda Shaffer, you're on patrol in Gaza.
Yeah.
You said that there were political arguments amongst yourselves as you went about things. Does what Martin is saying resonate with you at all?
No, of course, I'm outraged by some of the terms used by the gentleman, and, of course, most of them do not infer at all to the situation here. Israel has always used force only when it has had to, and we have always offered a peaceful solution, and therefore all that has been said is completely untrue. I think more and more Palestinians today realize that Arafat made a serious mistake leaving the negotiation table, and their lives could have been much better had he stayed and negotiations continued. The use of force by Israel now is a precondition to go back to the negotiation table. Palestinians have been led to believe that violence will get them somewhere, and violence will get them nowhere. Israel has offered several offers on the negotiation table, and including several solutions which would better their lives and address all their needs, as hinted by the gentleman, by the caller. But these generous offers have been rejected, and the Palestinians wouldn't even continue negotiating on that basis, and began a strike of violence. I think, as you said before, I agree with my colleague that there's no solution. Force is no solution on its own, but negotiations on their own cannot succeed as well. There has to be military force used as long as there are people on the other side who think they can get things done by violence. And I would suggest to our listeners to stop trying to justify always the violent side, because how are we going to justify Bin Laden and his terrorists? Terror is not justified. There's no need to go and look and search for the reasons of terror. Terror is used by many people for many reasons. I think our focus should be on the Palestinian people and their needs, and how we can work a peaceful solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and not trying to justify terror, whether it's in Manhattan or in the Gaza Strip or anywhere else in the world. Terror cannot be justified, and terror should not be justified as a means of achieving goals and political goals.
Just quickly, how long do you expect to be in the field, and what were you doing before you were called up?
My regiment was called for 5 weeks, and as I said before, we were called before in December for 4 weeks, so that's a pretty big load on my unit this year, but we accept it as part of this war of attrition. I myself am an official in the Ministry of Justice in my civil life. And in the army, I command a regiment together with other officers here who are all lawyers and accountants and contractors and other. Everyone has their own life and their own jobs, which they leave for about a month, 5 weeks. Most people here are damaged economically by the need to come here, even though we get paid a certain salary, but there's always indirect damage, but people are willing to sacrifice, and people are willing...
Okay. Lieutenant Colonel Shaffer, we're actually running out of time, and we're going to have to say goodbye and thank you for being with
us. Goodbye and thank you. Thank you.
Good luck. You're listening to The Connection at National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Lydon. This is The Connection, and we're talking in this hour about military options in Israel, whether they don't go far enough, whether they've gone too far. Our guests this hour are Gal Luft, former lieutenant colonel with the Israeli Defense Forces, and Jerry Green, director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation. Dr. Green, what do you think of the military option that Israel's tried? There are those who say that it seems to be trying everything but a solution that would lead to peace.
Well, I think that military means in and of themselves are of extremely limited utility, and my sense is that the Israeli leadership generally recognize this. The problem is that from an Israeli perspective, and you've been speaking to Israelis, so they can speak for themselves far more effectively than I can, but still my impression is that they are unlikely to engage on a political course in a fashion that creates the impression that they're responding to terrorism. So their challenge is to use the military as an effective means to resolve the situation in conjunction with political aims. The problem is that it doesn't seem to be working. And the question, as you've just asked it, is what's the appropriate mixture between political means and military means? And this appropriate mixture still continues to elude Israel, which is a serious, serious problem, both in terms of internal considerations within Israel, as well as the Israeli relationship with the Palestinian, which is troubled as it is not going to go away.
Do you have a feeling as an analyst that that leaders are running out of options, that, you know, we're talking about the possibility of a wall being built? Peaceniks are desirous of seeing such a thing happen. Do you feel that there's a sense of running out of military options without
the wall, you know, has always struck me as ludicrous. I think it's a sign of desperation rather than a well thought out plan. And not to sound partisan or political here, but you know, Prime Minister Sharon's commitment to using military means is well known. This is not the first time that he's done this. One only has to look at Israeli history to see that his efforts have been tried and have consistently failed. If we want to go back to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and so forth. But having said that, I have some significant empathy for the Israeli people, largely because the there's clearly a leadership void in Israel. And if this is the best that Israel can produce, then indeed the Israelis are in some measure of problem. The challenge is to avoid the sort of he said, she said. One of your callers was sort of giving a long dissertation on you know, Israeli history, using all sorts of colorful and probably not terribly constructive language. But the bottom line is that the Israelis have to find a measure between using diplomacy, politics, and the military, and they have not been able to do that. It hasn't happened. And in part, Tip O'Neill from Boston always used to say that all politics is local. This is clearly the case within Israel, and Israel seems to have almost emerged as a single-party country. When you find Shimon Peres serving in an Ariel Sharon government, there's a quality to that which is very, very peculiar, and one wonders what options are being presented the Israeli people, and lamentably, the options are extremely limited. So there really is an internal political dimension within Israel. But again, this is an uncomfortable discussion for me to have, because we can't talk about one half of the equation, which is the Israeli piece of it, without simultaneously discussing the Palestinian piece of the equation. And again, if we take the perspective of the Israelis, endless numbers of suicide bombers, daily threats to their very security and their ability to live, the attack on the Hebrew University and so forth, one can well understand why the Israelis appear to be flailing around, but on the other hand have a national obligation to their own people to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. So it really is a very, very difficult situation.
Let's get some of our listeners in. We're going to be giving out the number again, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Peter is calling from Buffalo, New York. Peter, hello.
Yes, the United States is unusual in that the entire international community considers Israel to be an outlaw state. Israel, for some reason, controls our foreign policy. We have certain principles. There is a recent report that 30% of the children on the West Bank are literally starving to death. That's not our principle. Why are we supporting the state?
Let's ask Gal Luft. You might want to address outlaw state. Gal Luft, would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, let me address the issue of starvation. Not one Palestinian child has starved to death. There is a problem of malnutrition, but I think that it's very different from what the caller has portrayed. Nevertheless, Israel is the only place in the Middle East that American flags are not being burned. Israel is the only place in the Middle East that there is a genuine friendship and genuine loyalty to the causes and the values of the United States, all those things that the United States is standing for and promoting. And I think that as long as this is the case, there is no better friend to the United States than Israel. And Israel has shown it for many years. And I think that It would be unjust to advocate that the United States should turn away from Israel just because some people in the world think that Israel is in the wrong side. And I think that also the portrayal that Israel is an outcast nation that is negated by the rest of the world is not accurate. We have many friends, including the Europeans, who have criticized Israel for many of its policies, but by the end of the day, we have much greater commonalities in terms of values and democracy with the Europeans than the Europeans have with the rest of the Arab countries.
When you have an intractable problem, like you obviously do with the Palestinians, I mean, it might be good to look back and look at first principles. How did this happen? Wasn't it a crackpot idea to found the state of Israel in a land that had millions of Palestinians living there?
Well, let's ask Dr. Gerald Green if he would respond to whether or not it's feasible to have a military option without the peace process. You were saying that that no, it isn't.
Well, no, I think that the two need to go in tandem. But I think that your caller's question, and I've been asked this a lot in various meetings and public talks I've given and so forth. But I think it's important to look at this within an American political context, that your caller is calling from Buffalo, the one to talk to if he's opposed to supporting Israel, and many people are quite critical of the relationship now, is, his congressman, his senator. I mean, this is a domestic political issue in the United States, and the American voters have not shown themselves to be tremendously unhappy about or uncomfortable with this relationship. So I think that we really have to not ignore our own role in this, that if we ask the question, why is the U.S. doing whatever, we have to look within the U.S. to find out why that's the case. More broadly, I absolutely believe that using military efforts which are not linked to companion political and diplomatic efforts is counterproductive in the extreme. I mean, what's so tragic is the debate between your caller and your other speaker, who the caller says that they're starving to death, and then the speaker says, no, they're not starving, they're just suffering malnutrition. I assume that that's correct. But this is a part of the world in which there shouldn't really be malnutrition either. I mean, the situation has really deteriorated precipitously to everyone's collective detriment. And the question is, what can be done in order to resolve this? And it's extremely difficult. And I don't think any correct-thinking person believes that military means in and of themselves are going to resolve what is ultimately a political problem. And lots of Israelis know this. This is not something that's particularly revolutionary. The question is, how do you use military means in order to protect yourselves while at the same time forging a political solution? And here you really need Palestinians on your show to sort of give their sense of why is it that they find themselves challenged by the ability to hammer out some sort of understanding or some sort of deal with the Israelis. I mean, the Israelis and the Palestinians have been down this road many, many times before. They were close and they didn't make it. The question is, what needs to be done this time?
Galef, do you think that Dr. Green comes close to the truth there?
I think that Dr. Green is absolutely correct when he says that there needs to be a way beyond the military means, and there should be a political agenda here. I think that what needs to be done, more specifically, is a mutual decision by both sides, Israel and the Palestinians, that they will together, both confront their rejectionist groups, those groups that have been dedicated to destroy any prospect for peace. And unless these groups are crushed with all the means possible, whatever it takes, I'm afraid that we will see more and more obstructionism, more and more. And remember that suicide bombing is not a phenomena linked to the Intifada. Suicide bombing was a phenomena that started actually in 1994 and 1995 when Israel and the Palestinians were on the road to peace. The Palestinian Authority must decide to eliminate Hamas, to eliminate Islamic Jihad, because these are the organizations that are dedicated to destroy any prospect of peace. and they're dedicated to the destruction of Israel. And they say it very, very clearly. They want to liberate all of historical Palestine, and as long as you have these people around, I'm afraid that we cannot move forward.
Let's take another phone call. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is on the line from Milwaukee.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, I wanted to make a comment regarding the wall, because that was one of the things that was proposed as a possible option at the beginning of the show. And although there's probably going to be a lot of people that are in objection to it, this is a desperate situation, you know, and clearly a wall, how could it not help, or a fence or something like that? There's been talk comparing it to, like, say, the Berlin Wall in the Germany days, but why was that wall built? You know, that was for people on one side of the wall to be held down and, you know, not live peaceful lives. This wall would be built so the people on the side of the wall would be able to live, hopefully, a more peaceful life. So that'd be a solution I'd certainly be all for.
All right. For either Gerald Green or Gal Luft, do walls always work so well? Gerald Green, let's go with you.
I think that it's a sign of desperation on the part of the Israeli government, which needs to demonstrate to its people that it's protecting them, something it's failed to do to date. I think that the levels of integration between Arabs and Israelis, or Palestinians and Israelis, is very, very high. And I think that a wall will not work. I think that there's an Israeli-Arab population. Those are Arabs who are citizens of the State of Israel and who can vote and so forth, whose situation is extremely difficult and doesn't get discussed as often as it should. And I think it's antithetical to the whole notion of Israel as a normal state existing within the region. Having said that, barriers always exist. They will continue to exist. But I think that to assume that a wall will in and of itself be effective probably ignores a broader question, which is how can these peoples live together? Having said that, nothing I've just said is not well known to both the Israelis and the Palestinians. If you read the Israeli press or the Palestinian press, everything we're saying today plus is in there. So that's the problem, that there's really a paucity of new ideas and good thinking on both sides.
Well, thanks for trying to give us some in any event. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay. Again, thanks to both my guests. Gal Luft is a former lieutenant colonel with the Israeli Defense Forces. Gerry Green is the director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Institute. Earlier, we spoke with Lieutenant Colonel Yehuda Shaffer, who's currently on duty in the Gaza Strip, and New York Times correspondent James Bennett. You can continue this conversation online at our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Lisa Chow, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our interns are Cara Arsenault, Clint Kavanaugh, and Orit Karitsky-Fox. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.